Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Christmas is almost here. On today's show, we'll take a step back in time to find out what Christmas was like in Harper's Ferry in 1864.
The war's coming to an end, and everybody feels that. And you can feel joy while you're feeling pain. I think anybody that's been through something like that could nod their head and say, yes, I understand that. You can actually experience joy when you also experience pain.
And we'll travel to West Virginia's first cidery, which is starting to make hard cider and mead made entirely from local West Virginia apples.
So, this is mead. Have you ever had mead before? And this, you're going to taste all of the different characteristics that you would expect from the apples.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
There's a chubby little bluebird calling. We got mistletoe and holly, and those flowers with the red leaves I forget. We got ice and little lickles, and a sunset so magical, and the evening's only barely started yet. Folks are on the pond out skating, careless practice serenading. Snowmen and women grow out of the ground. And where once it all was peaceful, now it's boisterous and gleeful. Oh, it's wintertime, the sun is going down.
Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of a growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It's Christmas time, which can mean a lot of things. Spending time with family, long to-do lists, or even heartache. And sometimes it all comes together. Today, we'll hear stories of Christmas past, Christmas present, and even hope for Christmases in the future. Let's start with a journey into the past. Every year, dozens of people in Harper's Ferry go back in time. In the shops and at the National Park, it's 1864 all over again. It's fun for locals and visitors to see how people in West Virginia celebrated Christmas in the Victorian era. But it's also a reminder of how bittersweet it can be for people to try and find a bit of good cheer in the midst of a long and terrible war. Liz McCormick with West Virginia Public Broadcasting brings us this look at a Civil War Christmas.
I'm walking along cobblestone streets in historic Harper's Ferry. It's still 2015, but it sure doesn't feel like it. Most of the buildings around me were built in the 1830s or 1840s. I'm surrounded by reenactors, dressed in Victorian style, women in plaid, poofy dresses, bonnets, and some with green or blue parasols. Some men are in black suits with a top hat. And some patrol the streets, dressed in their Union blues, keeping an eye out for Confederate guerrilla raiders.
My paws lift. Charge!
There's a blacksmith hammering in the distance. Some Union soldiers are looking for a sweet to eat at the confectionery, or they stop by the provost marshal's office to see if there's a letter or a package from home. A train rumbles by as I walk outside a Union soldier hospital. I'm only brought out of the magic when I see tourists dressed in modern clothes ogling the same scenes I am. I arrive at a large white tent. There's a small stage where two men play on instruments, one on a banjo, and the other taps a beat on a cow jawbone. Side of the stage are long tables with holiday crafts for children, and in the corner of the tent is a small Christmas tree decorated with popcorn and cranberry strands.
Mean, but he is in his appropriate blue uniform. Rebels have no space in gingerbread cookies.
22-year-old Colleen Moran stands next to her grandmother, Mary Lou Taylor. They're standing behind one of the tables in Victorian-style plaid dresses. They're decorating gingerbread cookies with visiting children.
There's colored icing and paper faces that you can put on the gingerbread, and the very difficult decision is always deciding whether you should give your gingerbread to the tree or if you should just eat it.
Moran's grandmother tells me how ornaments like the gingerbread cookies used to be the norm during the Civil War.
I explained to the visitors that They did not save ornaments from year to year. They made them fresh every year, and they made them out of things that were available, like nuts and pine cones and things like this. And then they would just throw them out at the end of the year. But during the Civil War, the German soldiers started bringing the glass-blown ornaments from Germany, and they remembered those. And so those became more popular. So it was actually during the Civil War that they started saving the ornaments from year to year.
Taylor and her granddaughter come from a family of history buffs. In fact, Taylor sewed the dresses the two of them are wearing. She's been volunteering at this event for almost 30 years. And for Moran, this is year number 16.
Well, it's very important just historically to this area to remind people of what happened here on this land and this place to the people who are related to a lot of the current residents here. They're their great-great-grandfathers or however many greats. They lived and celebrated and died here. There's a lot of memories here, and it's important to remember that.
This is the 45th year for the Old Time Christmas event in Harper's Ferry. It's put together by local businesses and the National Park Service, and it always happens the first weekend in December. John King is the supervisory park ranger for the Harper's Ferry National Historical Park.
All the activities here are something that actually happened here. And as much as possible at the original event location where they happened to.
King's colleague, Melinda Day, has left her ranger uniform home today. She's wearing a light green plaid dress, and her hair is pulled back in a low bun, sort of like Mary Todd Lincoln.
Because this is a historical park, and because we do have a rich Civil War history, we focus on the idea that Christmas and war coexist. Almost any visitor that walks into this park understands that someplace in this world, American service people are putting their lives on the line, even though it may be Christmas. And when a visitor steps into this park for a Civil War Christmas, that's the same story and relevance that resonates with them in modern times.
Day says Harper's Ferry was a strategic site in the war. It switched hands 14 times. And in late 1864, things were changing.
The war's coming to an end, and everybody feels that. And you can feel joy while you're feeling pain. I think anybody that's been through something like that could nod their head and say, yes, I understand that. You can actually experience joy when you also experience pain.
Private, I am told there's perhaps a package for me, a box sent from home.
Tom Bates is a reenactor portraying a Union soldier stationed in Harper's Ferry. There's a package waiting for him at the provost marshal's office from his wife. Some Union soldiers check the contents of the box to make sure there isn't any contraband or Confederate propaganda.
Sir, should we let him take the rest of the...
What else do we have here?
It looks like some clothes, and package of...
Yeah, clothing. Clothing is good. Yes, that's all approved.
We can approve all that.
Thank you very much.
Bates gets some warm clothes, a welcome reminder of home, especially at this time of year. But it wasn't always like this for soldiers during the Civil War. Sometimes they might get a letter saying their child or wife died from disease. Or sometimes it was the other way around. Again, Park Ranger Melinda Day.
Today, you know, UPS rolls up to our door. That makes us happy at Christmas time because we think joy is wrapped up inside of a box. But during the Civil War, it's going to be Adams Express that might send you a notice in the mail that you have a package waiting down at the depot and you need to get down there and pick it up. Well, it's your son's pocket watch. It's a small Bible that he carried in his pocket. Maybe it's a pocket knife that you gave him one Christmas long ago. Now you're getting it back. It's the reverse effect. There is no joy in this, but that's a Christmas of 1864.
Still, the soldiers stationed in Harper's Ferry in 1864 tried to make merry as best they could, even if some of them were far away from home at Christmas.
Oh, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will
rally. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Harper's Ferry.
Shouting the battle cry of freedom, the Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah, down with the traitor and up with the star, while we rally.
Today, I'm sure there are soldiers and sailors stationed away from home trying to make the best of the holidays. And then, There are families with loved ones in prison. Family members can't always visit, and inmates can't always get time on a phone line on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And this can be especially true for families of inmates in high-security prisons. And many of these prisons in rural Appalachia aren't accessible by public transportation. But families of inmates in 7 prisons in central Appalachia are able to connect to their loved ones through a radio show called Hip Hop from the Hilltops Calls from Home. Every Monday night, there are dozens of family members trying to get through to WMMT radio station in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Around Christmas time, the lines to the radio station are overloaded with families trying to get through. It's a show we first talked about last year on our Christmas episode when we listened to some of the messages left last Christmas.
Happy holidays, Uncle.
Happy holidays, Uncle James.
It's Gabriel.
It's Gabriel.
We love you.
We love you.
To my son, Mr. Devon Hall. Dad, love you, man. Always, forever, my brother. Love you, man. Wish you were here, but you're always here with us in spirit, soul, and mind, body, and soul. Saying we never gonna give up.
This year, a former producer of Hip Hop from the Hilltops, Sylvia Ryerson, actually left the studio and traveled to speak directly with some of the families. Sylvia worked with the families to capture scenes from their lives to broadcast for the inmates to hear. She went to Virginia to go with Devon's grandmother to church.
Hi, Devon. This is your grandma. You know what you call me. This is G-Ma, Grandma Essie. And I'm so blessed that we are on our way to church today. You know, every Sunday when I go to church, I generally carry you in my Bible. Well, I left you in North Carolina this week, that picture that I usually have with me. But I got you in my heart 24/7. And remember what I told you. Regardless of what everybody else do, you keep on keeping a prayer in your heart and spread that to your brothers. Because the more prayer y'all do, the heavier y'all can fight whatever demons may be trying to dance on you. Hey, are you ready? All right, we're heading out, and we'll be at church at 10 o'clock.
Good morning. How you doing this morning?
I'm Stella Thomas, your grandma's buddy and bud. But I wish you'd be have a blessed day, because I got a brother-in-law been dead 40 years now for something he didn't do. And they didn't let him out yet. I just hope he come free one day. Man, he ain't there for nothing, though. You know that? When you ain't got no lawyer, they railroad you. When you don't have money, that's the way it go. They take advantage of you. Yeah, we thinking about you this morning. We're going to sing for you.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, this audio letter was produced by Devon's family with help from producer Sylvia Ryerson. She's one of the original producers or DJs of the show Hip Hop from the Hilltops. WMMT broadcasts the show from the Apple Shop studio in Whitesburg, Kentucky on Monday nights from 7 until 10. The producer or DJ takes music requests for the first couple of hours, and from 9 until 10, families can call into the station to leave recorded messages for their loved ones in prison. Now, Sylvia's launched a new project called Restorative Radio. She collected messages in person from 9 families of inmates, and I've invited Sylvia Ryerson into the studio to tell us more. Hi, Sylvia.
Good morning, Jessica. Great to be here.
Sylvia, you heard from Devon's family many times over the years on the phone, I'm sure, when they called in for Hip Hop from the Hilltops. What was it like to meet them in person?
It was such a joy to get to meet these families in person and work with them. You know, outside of the studio, in their communities and homes. And
personally, that was a big reason I wanted to do this project. After being at WMMT and, you know, being a telephone operator, essentially, for so many years and hearing these voices and sort of hearing each other over the phone, we already had a relationship through the show, but to really sort of make that real and get to see each other face to face was so powerful.
Yeah, so we just heard a scene of the family going to church, and they took the recorder with them to record these sounds and send the scene, at least the sounds of the scene, back to Devon. And then I think the sound goes on. They make a trip back to the house. One of the things that Devon mentioned in the past was that he missed home-cooked meals. So the family is cooking this meal, and we're about to listen to a clip of them while they're cooking this meal. But Sylvia, tell us what you saw while this family was interacting, and what's it like to be there while this was happening?
Yeah, so this was, you know, a day in the life of Devon's family, and wanting to share that with him and include him in that. And so this whole project was really a collaborative project. And so I worked with his grandmother, Essie, and his mom, Krista, beforehand to figure out together, you know, what are the sounds and the people and the places that you want to share with Devon, and bringing him with you in that. And so that was kind of how together we planned out that piece.
Yeah, let's pick it back up where they're, I think they're waiting a little impatiently on dinner.
Now we're all sitting here waiting for the food that my brother, your uncle, was cooking prior to us leaving, and it has not come to fruition.
Ah, grates in the process of making our rice and our peas. So I'm getting ready to go back here and drop this fish. So this is our chief cook in here.
Making four cheese rice, homeboy. And we're gonna drop some fish. Man, you showed me how to work that thing.
Yeah, this message is going to the barn. He know that we need him here, because that boy will be in the kitchen cooking with me.
Fish, boy.
That's the apples that we're making. The apple with the cherry filling in the top, and I'm reheating some green beans that have like bits of garlic in it and some seasoned salt and butter.
So after that, Sylvia, what happened next? Did you finally get to eat?
Well, we did, and it was delicious. But before we ate, we all gathered round in a circle, and Essie, his grandmother, said a beautiful prayer, sending it out to Devon and telling Devon that he was in all our thoughts as we were there together. And throughout the piece, Essie did such a beautiful job of sort of bringing Devon into the scene. And so we all sat down and had dinner together. And then we started telling stories. And his mother, his uncle, his nephew, his brother, they were all there. And we just sat around the table and told stories about who Devon is, and their memories of Devon growing up.
Deontay was telling me that a little girl in his class that you helped with math when we were over at the Presbyterian Church with Reverend Reinhold, the little girl said she would have never graduated from school had you not taught her her math, and she really appreciated. You remember she had two or three little brothers, and all of them didn't know that you did your math from right to left. They thought that you pushed all the answer up under one line, and the teachers were just failing them. They weren't telling them that this is the way you do it, from right to left, and you extend it out. But she was able to graduate from school because of your help and your support.
I think from what Essie's saying here, you can just hear how proud she is of Devon and the Devon that she knows, and is reminding, you know, Devon of who he is to his family. And I think with those messages of encouragement and stories is also a real sense of looking towards the future and to tell him to hold on.
I want you to envision yourself, write notes to yourself, and envision yourself being a free man, because you have a lot to offer to the world. The devil might try to block you. Don't look at it like, oh, I may never get out of here. Envision it. If it doesn't happen one day, you've always known that we never give up. You keep on working on it, because I see you being home with us for the holidays.
She still believes in him and encourages him to believe in himself.
It's true. You can just hear how much love she has for him in that clip.
And we did hear his family talking about how he inspired a girl to graduate from school and a lot of other positive things. But he is in prison. What do you say to folks who might listen and say he's in prison for a reason and maybe criticize the show for even creating this platform?
I mean, the thing is, what first of all, what studies show across the board is if people incarcerated are able to maintain contact with their families and their communities at home, that's one of the most important things in terms of reducing recidivism once people get out. It's very difficult to travel to these prisons. The only way to get to them is by private vehicle. Many of these families live several hours distance away, and it's often very difficult to get phone calls through, and the cost of calling is very expensive. So there are so many barriers to communication, which is one of the reasons that this radio show, the Calls from Home show, exists as a way to sort of break through some of those obstacles that families face.
And there was another part of this trip in which Devon's mother really showed her unconditional love for her son. Let's listen.
Hey, Vaughn, this your mom. I'm getting ready to head back down this road. I came into Virginia just so I could have this experience for you, with you, about you, and I love you. And you know, I'm going to reiterate what your uncle and your grandma said. Continue to know that out here, we're on the level that we're fighting for you. We got things that we're sending out to whoever will listen. Just know that you are not alone, that things will go right for you. It just takes time. Unfortunately, it's taken us a long time. You're growing up in there. But keep your faith. Keep your strength. Just keep being that strong person. Also know that we never think, oh, Devon's going to stay in prison. We're going to always be fighting for a system that's going to do right. I know it's a lot of people that go to jail that should not be there. Fellas, always know that people are out here worried, they're trying to make some changes, where they can look at these crimes that are not committed, where we can look at the things that are done that are wrong. So, baby, with that being said, until I talk to you again, so call me soon. And fellas, we love y'all as well.
Did you ever look into their cases, Sylvia?
So the purpose of this series was not to, you know, reinvestigate each case. It was, you know, to help, to give these families a way to, you know, show their love for this person in prison. I can tell you some specifics about Devon's case, which is that he was sentenced when he was 19 years old to, he was convicted of carjacking, and no one was killed or seriously injured in the incident. And he has maintained his innocence the whole time, and because of that, he didn't take a plea deal, and so he's serving a 25-year sentence. And his name is actually was spelled wrong in all of his court records, and it continues to be spelled wrong today in the prison system. And so, you know, like many of the cases that I encountered, these are families that couldn't afford a lawyer, had court-appointed lawyers, and you hear sort of how their cases were kind of steamrolled through the court system. And so I didn't go back and investigate each case, but one of my goals for this project is that because these pieces are airing both for a specific individual in prison, but also reaching a larger radio audience, is to help change our idea of who is incarcerated in these supermax prisons. We make assumptions about people in supermax prisons being the worst of the worst. And when you start digging deeper about what sentences they're serving and how they got there.
It seems a little more complicated than some folks might hope to and choose to believe.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to not think about who's in prison here in Central Appalachia. And I hope that this project helps humanize the people that are here in our region.
Sylvia Ryerson, a former host of Hip Hop from the Hilltops out of WMMT, now an independent producer working on a new project called Restorative Radio. Thanks for sharing these stories with us, Sylvia.
Okay, thanks so much, Jessica. Bye.
The sounds we heard from the church and home in Virginia are from her latest project called Restorative Radio. It's a series of 3 one-hour shows airing on WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Sylvia visited families of 9 inmates to bring the sounds of home back to some of the prisoners. And you can listen to some of the other messages by going to our website at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. We'll be right back.
Will I be home for Christmas? You can plan on me. Oh, please have snow in mistletoe and presents under the tree. Will Christmas Eve you find me where the love light gleams? But I'll be home for Christmas if only in my
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
And now it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This is the time of year for family get-togethers and office parties, but do you know what town supposedly got its name for a shindig decorated with lanterns so bright and festive it looked like Christmas? Well, we'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So there are a lot of town names that spark the holiday spirit, such as Eggnog, Rudolph, Elf, and last year we even talked about Mistletoe, Kentucky. But when we heard about Christmasville, Tennessee, we just had to know more. We spoke with Jerry R. Cox of the Carroll County Genealogy Library about how the town got its festive name.
1819, settlers came from North Carolina to Macklemore's Bluff. They had a hoedown. They put up lanterns. They had a dance. And somebody looked up and said, "It looks like Christmas. We'll just call it Christmasville."
But that's not what all the locals say. One story says a group of men hauling cotton got stuck in a blizzard during the holidays, and afterwards settlers referred to it as that Christmas place. Some researchers attribute the name to John Christmas Macklemore, who owned the land when the town was commissioned in 1823. And just to make things a little bit more confusing, there were actually three different Christmasvilles.
The first Christmasville was down on the South Fork of the Old Bayonne River, and mosquitoes and the cottonmouth snakes were so bad that they decided they'd move to the second Christmasville. And the Christmasville School Road is where the second Christmasville was. Then the third, they moved to a blacktop where the present Christmasville is.
And unfortunately, these days, you won't find much left in Christmasville. Jerry Cox told us that as the railroad stopped bringing businesses to the area, the population has really dropped. He said the community has hardly had any businesses, no stores, and all that's left is basically just a few churches. But there's a lot of history in Carroll County, and probably even more stories to hear about Christmasville. So if you happen to be traveling in western Tennessee, stop in and say hi to Jerry R. Cox at the Gordon Browning Museum in McKenzie, Tennessee. And if you have another story about Christmasville or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. The holidays are a time to create new memories with their loved ones. Those memories become so precious and even painful when those loved ones are away. For this next segment, we want to pause for those that might not feel they have much to celebrate this holiday season, and perhaps give a little hope for those suffering. We checked in with the West Virginia Family Grief Center. It's a nonprofit organization that works to help families with children who have lost a loved one. It's the only one of its kind in the state. Stephanie Savage says she and a few other folks started the group about 12 years ago when they noticed that there wasn't much help for people who were grieving in the region. Was there any loss, if I could ask, in your life that you had experienced that might have motivated you perhaps on a personal level to do this?
Oh, yes. As a child, I was a griever. My father died when I was 10. And my older sister, Jessica Savage, died in a car accident when I was 33. There were other losses that I had experienced, and as a grieving child in particular, it was very difficult for me and my family. The death absolutely changed the construction of my family, and the Grief Center is designed to help families with children to deal with exactly what I had as a child.
Wow. So at the age of 10, you understand all too well what it's like to go through those anniversaries, the first, the second year, you know, Christmas and holidays. If you can, what kind of things, you know, what's it like for people that might not understand, that might be a little insensitive to it for those folks who have, especially children who have lost somebody?
Oh, absolutely. People don't mean to be insensitive. I'm sure of that. But when a person has had a loss, a child or an adult, it is completely life-changing. And the emotions that are stirred, that are normal, are very hard for the griever to experience and also to witness. Depending on the age of the child, their reaction will be different. For an adult, there's a lot of similarities in grieving, even though each loss is unique. The grief for an adult, especially at the holidays, is very difficult. And the children in the family are going to be influenced by how the adult handles the grief. Someone watching a grieving person would want to fix them, want to make them feel better, when in reality what they really need is someone to be kind, someone to allow time for them to talk, to not be frightened by tears. And that's kind of rare to find.
And it might seem kind of like an obvious question, but why do you think that, why is it that the holidays are can be particularly tough for folks who have lost a loved one?
For a number of reasons. Number one, there's the hype of the holiday, and everything is family-oriented and fun-oriented and happy-oriented. When a person has had a loss, they're not feeling any of that. Not very often, anyway. And they're feeling isolated and kind of like a downer for everybody else. So sometimes someone who is grieving will isolate, which is not a good thing for them to do. My advice usually for someone who's grieving is please be kind to yourself. Let yourself take what you need for time to feel the pain, let the emotions flow, and giving yourself permission to step away from chaos. What I found is most grievers are exhausted. Grieving is a very tiring thing. And then when all the hype of the holidays come in, they want to be thinking they should be part of it, when in reality they really need to be kind and give themselves permission to stay calm and quiet as much as possible.
I think you touched on this earlier in how people react to other folks who are in grief, and perhaps another person might not be grieving. If you're a friend or a loved one who knows somebody who is going through a loss, and this might be their first or even second time going through the holidays, what would be your advice for other people on how to interact with those folks to help?
That's a great question, 'cause everybody wants to help when someone you see someone in pain, emotional pain. And what I will definitely recommend is that if you are a support for someone who is grieving, be gentle with them. Help them understand that what they're feeling is normal. Be there to listen and to take care of themselves. You want to encourage someone to not completely isolate. But if, say, for instance, they're at a gathering and everyone is having a good time and there may be some chaos going on, if you're a support for someone who's grieving, keep your eye out for that person. And if you see that they might need a timeout, maybe suggest taking a walk or just sitting quietly, even if that person may need to leave the gathering and go home, let the person that you're trying to support understand this is normal, because they're thinking there's something wrong with them, when in reality it's not. And you said something a minute ago about whether the first or second year. There can be many years after a loss that someone will still have trouble with a holiday. And that's normal, too.
Yeah, that's a good point. It never really goes away. I mean, it's always a loss that a person has, I guess.
Yes, it's true. It feels different as the years go forward. Feels different, but it's still a loss.
Now, the facility is located in Morgantown. How can folks who might not live close to Morgantown get help like you all provide? Because I know you mentioned before, this is the only one of its kind.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what we will tell people is that they can contact the West Virginia Family Grief Center. We do have a website, too. They can contact the West Virginia Family Grief Center. We will send information if need be, if they can't get to us. We also will go to different, we have in the past, and we will continue to do this, go to different areas and give classes to people on how to handle grief and loss. We would gladly help another agency get started somewhere else in the city, in the state. We've presented in Wheeling. We've presented in Kanawha County, mostly to counselors, school counselors. Schools are really the front line when it comes to children and grief. Again, they can give us a call. We will get them the help they can. Support groups are wonderful for adults or for kids, and there may be some that they're not aware of in their area. Sometimes a local hospice, giving a call to a local hospice, they might have some information about support groups that the griever might not be aware of. So I would recommend that they call different hospices in the area. Sometimes churches will offer it. And so... Unfortunately, we meet with people that are within 50 miles of our center in Morgantown. But you're right, we need more in the state.
You mentioned support groups and making that phone call and reaching out. Sometimes it seems that it's really difficult for people who are grieving to reach out, or they might not realize that they are actually going through this grieving process. And you hear a lot of times, I'm okay, I don't want to be in any trouble, it's okay, I'll be fine. What would you say to those folks that might be hesitant to reach out?
Well, basically, number one, I would say normalizing them, telling them, absolutely, I understand that you don't want to be a burden to anyone. You don't want to be a problem to anyone. But understanding it is hard to be around people that don't get it. My support group that I run, many of the people come there to be around people who get it, who understand about loss. So I would encourage someone who might be reluctant to try a support group, only because that's when you'll be around people that understand what grief is. Normalizing, telling people that, yes, what you're feeling is normal. All of the emotions of grief are normal. And knowing that they are not isolated, that they're part of a group of people that can help.
And Stephanie, would you have anything else that you'd like to add and share with our listeners as we approach the holidays, the Christmas and New Year's celebrations?
Yes, just one small thing. Be kind. Please be kind to yourself. If you're the griever, please be kind to someone that you know is feeling the pain of loss. We don't mean to be unkind, but making a special effort to be kind.
Be kind. And we hope that it spreads holiday hope to all of our listeners.
Absolutely.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Jessica. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess all of us adults are carrying around some kind of loss this holiday season. But it's songs like this that really make me smile and treasure the happy moments I have with my loved ones. It's called Silvery Bells, and it was recorded by Richie Collins, and, well, I just love it. It reminds me of my Pawpaw Dean, who died just a few years ago. I imagine he would sing this song just like this.
Children laughing, people passing, meeting smile after smile, and on every street corner you hear silver bells, silver bells. It's Christmas time in the city, ring-a-ling, hear them.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. From Silvery Bells to Sleigh Bells, now we want to share a Christmas story with you told by the Poet Laureate of West Virginia, Mark Harshman. He recently wrote a children's book called Mountain Christmas. It's about sleigh bells, heard by all sorts of people and creatures in iconic scenes found throughout the mountain state. Glennis Board sat down with Harshman and illustrator Cece Rose and brings us the tale.
High on the mountain, the first snowflake falls. A white hare shivers. Her nose twitches. Her long ears stiffen.
What is that?
She hears. Could it be sleigh bells? In the broad, wooded valley within a frosty fog, a hoot owl repeats, who, who, who. A man shovels snow. He catches his breath, raises his head. What can that be? Suddenly, he remembers the ringing of sleigh bells.
Mark Harshman is reading the first few stanzas of his newly published children's book, Mountain Christmas. Harshman says the owner of the West Virginia Book Company, Bill Clements, approached him a couple years ago about writing the book.
It's a book about Santa Claus coming to West Virginia, and as an author wanting to make a West Virginia-friendly book, I was intentional about including a diverse range of places here in West Virginia, such as the state capitol, the Green Bank Observatory, the Wheeling Suspension Bridge, Blackwater Falls, and so on. At the observatory, the crew is small on Christmas Eve. The astronomer checks her instruments and finds a blip on her screen, then another and another. 8 plus 1? She cracks her window. What does she hear? Impossible. But even a scientist knows the sound of sleigh bells. The soldier has driven all night to get home for Christmas. He is tired and sleepy. He pulls off the highway, cracks his window, and just as he's falling asleep, sleigh bells? Yes, could only be sleigh bells. A train whistle pierces the silence as it rolls through the old town. A woman looks up the street, listens for the sound of tires crunching through the snow, but instead hears something that sounds like something from long, long ago. Sleigh bells? When the miner lays down his bucket and gulps the fresh air, he looks to the sky and is it a trick of his eyes? The white beard? Red coat? 8 tiny reindeer, and the clear ringing of sleigh bells?
Stanzas feature other people as well, like a barge captain on the river, and of course, children.
I wanted to capture that sense of joy and anticipation, that longing, even a certain poignancy, which might not appeal to, might not be recognizable by a child, but will be instantly and hopefully appealing to an adult reader.
Harshman says the process of creating the book was unique. He worked closely with editor Bill Clements and was able to choose and work with a friend and local illustrator, Cece Rose.
It was a first for me. It was a real project.
Rose is a Wheeling artist and a teacher.
He really provided with his stanzas the visual pictures for me. And Bill was all about the magic. He kept telling me, just make it magical. So that wasn't hard, really, because I had a lot of input from my students who were all very young.
The 17 illustrations are bright and vivid acrylic paintings. In life, they're about 11 inches by 14 inches, which is pretty close to the actual dimensions of the hardback book, which stands 11 inches tall and 8.5 inches wide. Rose says it took about 7 months to illustrate the entire book.
Santa was the biggest challenge because I didn't want him to look too comical or too cartoonish, so I referred to a lot of classical children's books and how I remembered Santa, and he came out sort of Nordic looking, don't know why, but anyway, I was pleased with that, and I loved the idea of the sleigh bells, so throughout every illustration, the sleigh bells are appearing somewhere in the picture, even if Santa doesn't.
Perhaps one other notable feature was publisher Bill Clement's decision to use a special font called Open Dyslexic. The new open source font has letters that are weighted at the bottom and spaced a little more widely to make reading a little easier for folks with dyslexia.
Robbie sits by a sparkling tree waiting for more than presents. And a sleepy traveler is back on the road. The snow is so thick he can hardly see, but suddenly there are those bells again and something flying through the sky. He follows and, his window down, listens for those bells. Robbie hears them too, and then hears a car, hears the horn honk. He dashes outdoors and sees Santa disappearing into the high, white sky, just as his father's car slides to a stop in the drive. Papa, Robbie shouts and runs to his father's arms. Christmas has come now and never to be forgotten. And fading into the night, we all hear what sounds just like sleigh bells.
The book is called Mountain Christmas. You can find out more about it and where to find it online at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
And finally, we end the show with a new Appetite Appalachia segment that might help you get into the holiday spirit. We're excited to tell you that West Virginia's first alcoholic cidery has just opened. This holiday season, you may be bringing a bottle of wine to a family gathering or a Christmas party, but if you want to offer your friends a drink that's made from local Appalachian ingredients, you might consider alcoholic cider. Heirloom apples grow abundantly in Appalachia, making a region ripe for brewing cider. The cider business is booming in parts of Appalachia. As a matter of fact, in Virginia, 18 cideries exist, and last year their sales jumped 200%. Industry analysts expect the cider boom to continue. Just over the border in West Virginia, Hawk Knob Cider and Mead, the very first facility to brew hard cider in the state, recently opened its doors. Owner Josh Bennett and Will Lewis started making cider together as a hobby 9 years ago when they were at West Virginia University. Roxy Todd recently traveled to their cidery for a preview tasting, and she brought back this audio postcard.
Well, here we are in the Greenbrier Valley. We're basically at the base of Muddy Creek Mountain. It's a pretty wide valley for West Virginia, and it has these gentle rolling slopes, which, to me has always spoken to me, and it just feels really good here. It's a wonderful place for, fruit trees, apples in particular. I'm Will Lewis. I'm a co-owner of Hawk Knob Hard Cider and Mead.
I'm Josh Bennett, co-owner of Hawk Knob Hard Cider and Mead. This is really, it's a real dream. I know that sounds like a cliche, but we've just really, this has been a real deep passion and dream of ours ever since starting brewing mead together in cider back in college.
So I started making mead, and that really piqued Josh's interest too, because he's been making cider, growing up his life.
Yeah, I had grown up making hard cider. Where I grew up in Highland, Virginia, which borders Pendleton and Pocahontas, just about everybody had a cider barrel in their cellar. And so I grew up making anywhere between 5 and 8 barrels a year. So that was pretty traditional. And then when we started making mead together, we started making cider and mead in college, and I think we were already dreaming of doing this commercially from that time.
I'm Haley McIntosh. And this is?
I'm Trevor McIntosh.
And we are here at Hawk Knob trying some cider today.
Well, might as well, you want to get a little tour of the facility? You've already had it.
Yeah, sure.
The vat's over here on the left, is where we do most of the primary fermentation at. That's also how we carbonate the cider at the end of the process.
Well, let's try some cider.
So this is really what I grew up making, and I just still can't get away from drawing cider right out of the barrel because it's working through its process. It's still fermenting. The cider's still got a lot of floral stuff coming out in it. You're getting kind of the freshness of the barrel at the same time. It's pretty exciting when you drink a raw cider that's still working right out of the barrel. And in our traditional cider, we've really tried to kind of replicate the sort of effervescence that you have in a cider that you pull out of the barrel. We've kind of really got the most minimal amount of carbonation in that style, in the traditional hard cider, to replicate this, what's coming right out of the barrel.
It smells really good. I really like this.
So, this is mead. Have you ever had mead before? So this, you're going to taste all of the different characteristics that you would expect from the apples, but then you're also getting all the characteristics of the honey. And
oh, I definitely taste the honey.
So
that's what
honey,
that is.
If you think about
do you
it,
taste
it,
the honey? It lingers on too.
Yeah.
Like I still taste it.
We don't like drinking sweet stuff, so we make dry mead and dry cider. And our meads, we feel we age them, we oak age them, and they're really dry and complex, and we feel they could even stand up to other types of table wine, like Chardonnays, or even the red fruits could be compared to Merlot or Pinot Noir even. And it's a product, cider and mead for that matter, are products way better suited to our region agriculturally than French hybrid grapes, you know. This is apple country, probably one of the best apple growing regions in the country next to the Northwest. So if we could get off French hybrids and move towards our heritage in apples, that would be a good thing for us to do in West Virginia. All of these apples were sourced locally and actually all from one farm in Monroe County, Morgan Orchard.
What is an elderberry?
An elderberry?
What is that?
That's a real, so it's, they grow all through Appalachia.
Oh, okay.
And in elderberries, it's a kind of a low shrub. They're pretty ripe in the late fall. And traditionally, a lot of people used to make elderberry wine in the fall, all through Appalachia. So we kind of took off on that tradition and steeped the elderberries in our cider. And actually,
that
that's what we're going to have now,
actually. Elderberry, I never heard of such a thing.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful color. This is like a deep kind of burgundy rouge color. It's very similar to what you would expect to see in like an aged wine. That's what this color reminds me of, an aged red wine.
I like that.
People are really seeking craft hard cider now. We're the first one in West Virginia, and we're proud to be, but it's pretty shocking to me that we are the first one in the state. You know, there's really not many better places to be making hard cider, and it's truly part of our cultural heritage. It's part of our past, and we should be reviving it.
The Hawk Knob Cidery is now doing tastings by appointment, and next spring they will begin distributing cider to restaurants in Fayetteville and Slaty Fork, West Virginia. If you're looking for a place to taste craft hard cider, we've put more information about Hawk Knob along with some links to websites of cideries in Virginia and North Carolina on our website, wvpublic.org. The meaning of Christmas has changed a lot for me since I was a kid. I never thought I'd get to spend some of the season with you as host of a public radio show, but I'm so glad that I did. And till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia and making Inside Appalachia part of your holiday season. Cheers.
So someone get a punch bowl or whatever thing my jig will hold. A little ice and a lot of something cold. We ain't got a lot of punch, but that's all right. We got a bunch of other stuff to make the church bells toll.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT. Music in today's show was also provided by Josh Ritter, Corey Chisel, and the Wandering Sons, as heard on Mountain Stage, the Richie Collins 3-0, and our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio.
Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixer is Scotty White. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org, find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Last night, she didn't see me creep downstairs to have a peep. She thought that I was tucked up in my bedroom fast asleep. Then I saw Mommy tickle Santa Claus underneath his beard so snowy white. Oh, what a laugh it would have been if Daddy had only seen Santa Claus last night. I saw Mommy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night. She didn't see me creep downstairs to have a peep. She thought that I was in my bedroom fast asleep. Tucked up.